Hello, Connor.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Not too bad. Why don't I introduce us? I'm Robert Wright, publisher and editor in chief of the Non-Zero Newsletter. You're Connor Eccles, as you may know, managing editor of the Non-Zero Newsletter.
Indeed.
And this is Non-Zero World, the weekend podcast of the Non-Zero Media Empire.
Yeah, that Bob is now hijacking, as you can see. He
That's
has done the
not the way I
intro.
would just, that is the opposite of the truth, as I'm about to explain to you. Okay.
Oh,
So
okay.
I have a couple of housekeeping items here, and one of them is the future of this show. Okay. So the show is in flux until very recently. Your co-host was Andrew Day. As it happens, he got a compelling offer from an even bigger and more richly resourced media empire. Who knew that there was such a thing? Apparently there is.
Yeah.
Plus it's like a good place for him to be, which on foreign policy shares many of our values. But so I'm kind of a placeholder. I'm a mere placeholder. Don't get used to looking at me, okay? We're trying to figure out exactly what's going to happen with the show, but the more I think about it and talk to people about it, including conversations you're not even party to, okay? I've scoured the globe for creative geniuses. I'm talking to a guy in Spain, a creative genius in Spain, about what we're going to do with the show. His name is Nikita. And he has some ideas. And all I can say is that we have plans for you, young man. You're going
Good
to
to
be
know.
big. You're going to be big.
That's big. This is good. I feel like I'm getting the really getting the shoulder tap, you know what I mean? Did you see did you watch that SNL movie that recently came out? There's a Chevy Chase scene where there's like a director or there's some like bigwig from the studio that comes down and taps him and is like, you know, you're going places, kid, and he's obviously thrilled. Go
Well,
straight to his head. It's gone
I
straight to
would
mine.
say that Chevy Chase pioneered the weekend update format. I'm old enough to
Right?
remember his very first his debut, I believe, the first Saturday Night Live episode ever. That's not entirely unrelated, in a certain sense, to one of the many things that may happen with this show. All I can say with confidence is that within weeks of the launch of the new show, whenever I refer to you as Connor, people are going to accuse me of name dropping. Okay?
Wow.
I'm going to be
Wow.
like, no, I really know him. Really, I do. That's how
That's the
big
dream. That's the dream.
it's going to
Well,
happen.
in the meantime, so we'll have lots to talk about here, but people should stick around also for the second half of this show after Bob and I have this discussion, which is going to hit on AI, is going to hit on some Trump foreign policy updates, and then I'm going to talk to sort of national security law expert Elizabeth Beavers about a bit of an unsung story of the early Trump administration, which is its use of various different forms of terror designations and its expansion of some of those for different groups. So definitely stick around for that. But do we want to talk about
That
do we have
sounds
more
good.
housekeeping or do we want to do?
A little bit. First of all, we did solicit applicants for jobs. We're hiring. We're going to fill Andrew's position plus hire one or two part-time people. The applications have come in. The deadline is over, but we got a lot. We got like what, 140, 150 applications.
Yep.
And it's honestly kind of heartbreaking because there's so many qualified people. Way more than we can hire, more than we can even interview. And some of them clearly, have been reading newsletter for a long time or listening to podcasts or both, and obviously share the values, and the sense of mission of the whole enterprise. So it's it's kind of sad that we can't hire a ton of people. But I want to thank everybody who
Yeah.
did send in an application. Final housekeeping is well, it's a good segue because it's just about the newsletter. You have been the guest editor, I guess, as we're putting
Right.
it, of the Earthling, the weekend edition of the newsletter. Traditionally, I had been the person who goes through, edits everything, writes some of the items from scratch, especially often the lead item, does any rewriting I gratuitously want to do. But some weeks ago, I had to launch on a crash program to finish a book. I guess 3 weeks ago, and you became the guest editor. Now, last week you were sick, so I kind of stepped in and did more of my traditional role, which I think means you owe me another week. Is that right? So it's like
I believe
this
that
week
is true.
And then
I
three more.
That's true. They're transferable. They are transferable. That's a tough sick policy, but I think that's what we got to do.
Now I did, so I haven't seen this week's issue. You can tell me about it and we can talk about it. I did humbly submit to you a short item on AI. I don't know if it wound up meeting your editorial standards.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah,
you may
tough.
Not have a job tomorrow, but I'm hopeful that it did. But that's all I know. The rest is a mystery to me. And that's about AI. I do want to talk about AI. Do you want to quickly mention, before we get into AI and some other things, what some of the highlights in the newsletter?
Yeah.
I don't know what they are.
Yeah, that's true. Bob does not know what they are. But the big lead item this week is looking at the ways in which the sort of whole of government has been Elon Muskified in this first couple of weeks. We saw sort of an extraordinary amount of influence within some of the more like unsung offices, right? Like the Office of Personnel Management. We saw this mm-hmm. email get sent out that had the exact same subject line as the email that he sent out to all Twitter employees. And he sent this out to all federal employees, essentially offering them a legally dubious buyout. Apparently there is at least like four or five staffers that are like Elon people at that office and who are kind of running the show right now, including one who is an 18-year-old who had interned at Neuralink. So, you know, things are going really well. And then the broader kind of like Musk philosophy of cuts we've obviously been seeing in everything, right? We've seen foreign aid cuts across the board, or at least pauses. We've seen an attempt to essentially freeze all federal grants and loans, which scared the hell out of everyone until a judge blocked it. It's kind of unclear. So that's
well,
the big...
I think Trump withdrew it. I mean, that was just ridiculous. I think that because there was this, so the White House spokesperson
right.
was defending it. And they said, well, what about Medicaid? Will this affect Medicaid? And she said, well, I don't know. I mean, I'll have to check. Well, that's 80 million people. Okay. And yeah. I think it turned out it actually was creating complications. And that includes some, you know, that's it goes to low income people, includes some Trump voters. I think they withdrew that whole order, I believe. And I'm sure we'll re-implement some of it. But it's just chaos.
Yeah, it's shock and awe. It's really, I mean, you know, some people have pointed out, and we point this out too, that there's this sort of, like Elon Musk has, as related by Walter Isaacson and in his biography, has this sort of like five-step process for making organizations more efficient. And step one and two are basically just like slash everything and ask questions later. Mm-hmm. And we are absolutely living through that right now.
Yeah, no, it's funny. Just this morning, I was reading the latest Musk casualty. I think some actually pretty highly placed person who lost his job apparently as a result of Musk. And I was thinking, some people have been speculating, okay, he's going to come in and suggest budget cuts, and people have tried before. Good luck getting it through Congress. Nothing's going to happen. And it's just the opposite. I mean, he's a true player. We'll see. So what else? What are other newsletter highlights?
Yeah, another interesting one that we brought up. This one, I think, is going to be below the paywall, but maybe I'll give people a little taste, is that we noted that there was this big spat, kind of the first diplomatic dust up of the Trump administration with the president of Colombia, Gustavo Petro. Mm-hmm. The long story short of that is that Trump attempted to send deportees on military planes. Colombia took issue with that, rejected the planes, mm-hmm. and Trump took issue with that, taking issue and said that he was going to, you know, put massive sanctions, a visa ban, tariffs of like 25% across the board on Colombian exports to the United States, all those things. And it all kind of wrapped up within a day and it's back to normal. But what I found really interesting was the reaction from the foreign policy establishment, which, you know, immigration people had their own view on it, but the foreign policy establishment really focused on one thing, which is that this is giving a huge win to China. And I thought
a lot of this stuff is, but go ahead.
But it sort of is and it isn't, right? Because that's only in the narrowest view. That's the argument that I'm making, is that sure, in a sense, it's a win for China for us to have these diplomatic battles. But the fact that we have a president who is engaging in all of these things, who is doing this, and our only critique of it is that it's giving an advantage to some other country in mm-hmm. this Cold War framework. I mean, that is just the exact wrong way to look at international politics, right? It's not a zero-sum game.
Although it may be the way to get attention in Washington. I mean, maybe the most effective talking point these days. What I was thinking of in terms of China, and I mean, you said Colombia was I think you called the first diplomatic dust-up. A lot of competition for that title. I guess if you carry the timing out to the tenth of a second, you can decide which one came first. But anyway, what I was thinking about as far as China is they suspended like all foreign aid. They've frozen like all foreign aid.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, includes things like monitoring outbreaks of bird flu, right, which is something that protects Americans, given that, pathogens tend to cross borders. But also just it includes a lot of stuff that was genuinely helpful to people, and the freezing of it will cause human suffering. And, right. But that's obviously an opportunity for China, big time.
Well, it's an opportunity for China, but it hurts China too, right? Like us pulling out of the WHO hurts everybody in the world, right? And us stopping some of these aid programs or pulling back on them, these are problems that, like you said, they don't respect borders, right? These are things that affect us all, even in this, like, if in a narrow geopolitical sense, they help China, it hurts everybody.
Right, right. On a geopolitical plane, and the foreign aid suspension is separate from the WHO thing. But to get back to geopolitics, this allows China to exert more influence on the WHO because it will be providing more of the funds. We complain that China has too much influence on the WHO, and then we withdraw our funding and eliminate all of our influence. It's genius level global chess.
Yeah, while we're on China, do we maybe want to talk about the item that you sent in so humbly about our friend Dario Amade and his view on China?
Yeah, so Dario Amade or Amodai, we don't know, I guess. He is the head of Anthropic, which, what I called him in the item, I said to establish his importance, I said Anthropic is one of the three big makers of like proprietary LLMs in the US, along with Google and OpenAI. But actually, he's more important than that. I mean, as a figure in the AI community, he more than any single person was behind GPT when he was at OpenAI. I think he led the team. He was the believer in scale, and he's highly respected, and I'm sure rightly so. And this is going to seem ironic when I elaborate on things. He led a bunch of disaffected OpenAI people who felt that Sam Altman was not sufficiently concerned about AI safety and AI risk, and went over and started Anthropic. Okay, so Anthropic was considered, okay, these are the good guys. In the AI safety risk community, they're like, okay, Sam is proceeding headlong without regard for risk, but at least we have the good guys at Anthropic. Well, now Dario has come out in reaction to, everyone calls him Dario, I don't know him. You can accuse me of name dropping, but I'm not, because I don't know him. In the wake of the DeepSeek thing, which I guess most people have heard about now, this Chinese LLM that the combination of affordability and performance kind of shocked a lot of people. Some people were saying this means the chip export controls, the attempt to cut off China's supply of advanced microchips is not working. Look, if anything, it encouraged these researchers to get more out of what chips they had. Dario posted a thing this week that, first of all, fights that narrative. He's a big proponent of the chip wars, as is now Sam Altman, and obviously it works to the benefit of American AI companies.
Yeah.
Not to the benefit of NVIDIA, which isn't so enthusiastic, but to the benefit of AI companies. So in that sense, it's not shocking that they would like it. But anyway, so he posted this thing that, first of all, pushed back on the narrative that this Chinese model is an indictment of the chip war as a tactical device. He said, no, it's critical that we do it, and demonstrated what a thoroughgoing China hawk he is, I think in a genuinely ideological sense. Now, as you know, he co-authored it. I mean, this isn't the first, you know, we've written about this. We kind of knew he was a China hawk, although some of the language he uses here is striking by my lights for its extremity, and I'll get to that. But as you know, he co-authored a piece with Matt Pottinger in the Wall Street Journal on China a few weeks ago. I don't know, how would you characterize Pottinger? I might go overboard if we leave it to me. In like, is rabid China hawk fair?
I think he is one of the most, maybe the best way to describe him is the fact that he has been very influential in pushing things towards China hawkishness in the discourse, right? He has been a fairly singular figure from his time in the Trump administration in driving forward the idea that China poses a very serious threat to the United States that must be countered very aggressively.
Right. And it's funny. I don't know if Dario thinks that because Pottinger served in the Trump administration, it was wise to ally himself with Pottinger. Mm. He may not understand that there's reason to think Trump hates Pottinger. After January 6th, Pottinger came out full-throatedly against Trump. But anyway, right. So he's a China hawk. Quickly, before we get to that more, there were a couple of interesting technical points in Amadei's post that I didn't have time to get into in the newsletter. I got into the China hawkism, his saying, you know, this is a death struggle. Well, I mean, actually, I'll go ahead and quote that part of his paper. He says, he's saying, he writes that, okay, he wants, you know, if we're successful in the chip war, and we have better AI models in China, then we will live in, quote, a unipolar world where only the U.S. and its allies have these models. And then he writes, granted, quote, it's unclear whether the unipolar world will last, but there's at least the possibility that because AI systems can eventually help make even smarter AI systems, a temporary lead could be parlayed into a durable advantage, unquote. And then he writes that then, quote, the U.S. and its allies might take a commanding and long-lasting lead on the global stage, end quote. Now, by the way, to people immersed in the whole AI discourse that these people are immersed in, what he's talking about is the point where supposedly there will be like this super intelligence takeoff. It's not going to be like the singularity, okay? That's what he's describing, and he knows that. So he's basically saying, you know, if we can just control this one moment, we'll have utter world dominance. I'll get back to that a little, but the two interesting technical points he made. First of all, he argued somewhat persuasively that how amazing the cost reduction of the Chinese model is has been somewhat overstated, not entirely. He admits they've thought up some clever ways to cut training costs. But he argues for various reasons that it's not as impressive as you might think, although impressive, it is cheap and performative, as they now say. Performative is a word that I think is entering the lexicon via AI, at least as a common word. The second point he makes is related to that. I found this particularly interesting, you know, and this speaks to the stock market crash. It's a response to that. Well, the crash of chip stocks, including NVIDIA. He says one of the reasons that this idea that chips aren't going to be as valuable as we thought is wrong is the following. Okay. First of all, you have to distinguish between the kind of scale to bigger and bigger chip clusters that led to GPT-4, GPT-2, 3, 4. And again, this was his baby up to a point. So he knows that. And the second, you know, and that seems to be kind of starting to level off in terms of the effectiveness, you know, diminishing returns. Mm. But he says, now with these new reasoning models, where what you're cultivating is this so-called chain of thought capacity, that's going to be a whole nother scaling thing. And so just as with the first scale, it's like, okay, GPT-2 costs like whatever, 4 million to train. I don't know what the numbers are. Then 30 million and then 100 million. He says, you're going to see the same thing here. So it's not surprising that it didn't. This is one of the reasons not surprising it didn't cost much to train the Chinese model. One of what he would say is several reasons. But he said, but don't kid yourself. As the chain of thought dimension of this benefits from scale, you are going to see bigger and bigger chip clusters for a while. And then presumably that will level off. That's a genuinely interesting point. The only other thing I'd say about this whole thing really is that it is so frustrating. You know, there's so many China hawks out there, including in the AI community. Some, I think, are doing it cynically just to get more government funding and to keep themselves free of regulation. I don't really think he's in that category. And in fact, I would add something. So I kind of, near the end of the piece, we quote this thing he said in 2017, just because when he came out with this very hawkish post this week, the safety advocates jumped on it and they dredged up this 2017 clip where he's warning about some of the downside of a U.S. AI, U.S.-China AI race. And he said then, quote, this will create the perfect storm for safety catastrophes to happen if we're racing really hard to do something, and maybe even some of those things are adversarial. That creates exactly the conditions under which something can happen that not only our adversary doesn't want to happen, but we don't want to happen either. If you listen to the whole clip, it's clear that he's not saying don't engage in the competition. He's saying do it carefully. And I don't see any signs now that he's doing it carefully. But anyway, he has, and this just speaks to, I think, the sincerity of his view about China. I think it's longstanding. And the way he fleshes it out in this piece is, first, he says nice things about DeepSeek. He says, I don't see DeepSeek themselves as adversaries, and the point isn't to target them in particular. In interviews they've done, they seem like smart, curious researchers who just want to make useful technology. But they're beholden to an authoritarian government that has committed human rights violations, has behaved aggressively on the world stage, and will be far more fettered in these actions if they're able to match, far more unfettered in these actions if they're able to match the U.S. in AI. You know, because I have a podcast, often when I see something I disagree with, I think, well, I'll have him on the podcast. And here's what I'll ask. Now, in this case, I'm fantasizing. He's not going to come on my podcast. But, the first thing I thought of is, like, has behaved aggressively on the world stage? I mean, okay, look, yes, China, like, border skirmish with India, although in compliance, oddly, in compliance with a treaty, they both comply with the treaty. So there were no guns. They were like beating each other to death with sticks, like literally. And
people did die. That is the crazy thing.
No, people died.
They did literally just go back to like Stone Age warfare.
Yeah, there may have been knives. I don't know. But and then, of course, they're pushing the bounds in these maritime disputes. All granted. Okay. But China hasn't invaded a country since 1979. Since then, the U.S. has invaded multiple countries illegally, and at least one legally, Afghanistan. Persian Gulf War was legal, and then we bombed countries both legally and illegal. I mean, so when he says has behaved aggressively on the world stage, just the lack of self awareness, which is it's characteristic of the whole foreign policy establishment. It's not like he's relatively ill informed or relatively lacking in perspective. And then even on the human rights thing, obviously China has a very bad human rights record, but I was thinking about this and I thought, I mean, Exhibit A is obviously the Uyghur thing, okay? Involuntary internment of very large numbers of people who have not committed a crime for the most part, and for, quote, re-education. I don't know to what extent it's like prison and what extent it's like a dorm room, but they don't want to be there. And then they re-educate them and I guess, I don't know, teach them Mandarin and do various other things. And there really is a dimension of trying to maybe not erase Islam altogether, but if not, then, make it very regime friendly. And it's horrible, but I kind of thought, like, I wonder what Dario would say if I said to him, that's really bad. Involuntary internment on a large scale, all this stuff is horrible. But in the last year in Gaza, the U.S. has willingly provided the weapons that actually killed people. Okay, we didn't just lock them up. We killed 1 in 40 Gazans, most of them civilians, probably maimed 1 in 40. I mean, I don't have to recite all of this for you. And of course, it kept up long past the time when any reasonable person could say it was vital to Israel's national security. And I was wondering, would he say, well, but that's not the violation of human rights of Americans? To my mind, that makes it worse in a sense, because I can, like, Israel, it's more understandable that they would overreact to the trauma of October 6th than that we would sit here under no threat whatsoever from Hamas and go, yeah, spend another week. Here's the ammo. Kill another bunch of people. We know most of them are civilians. Keep it up. Yeah. Is it? And I just want to say, you can argue that the Uyghur thing is worse than that. Fine. But for purposes of Dario's argument, it has to be way worse. He's saying China is a whole nother order of being, okay? That's how bad they are. This is a death struggle. Yes, there are risks, which he acknowledged in 2017. And I think if you got him in a room, he would concede that, yes, there would be huge benefits to having a sufficiently cooperative relationship with China to address all kinds of possible downsides of AI, which I believe strongly. But I just, you know.
Yeah, it seems like there's just some skipping ahead going on, right? There's this. I mean, this is the exact problem with the Cold War thing, because, like you said, it's the problem isn't competition on its own, right? Like the fact of DeepSeek having this model out has done interesting things, right? It had, like, OpenAI released some information about the accuracy of its model in response to DeepSeek in order to say that their model was more accurate, right? It forces more information into the public ecosystem. It's a good thing. But the problem is, when you've got this kind of Cold War mindset, when you've got this idea that China equals the Soviet Union in the, like, 60s and is somehow, you know, and at the time, the Soviet Union and the U.S. were both actively, you know, engaged in armed struggles in different areas. They were actually encouraging people to rise up against governments. That really just does feel like a very different situation that we've now grafted on to China, right? And there's now just this argument that you can justify essentially anything because China is so ontologically evil that it's just, we must, right? But it just doesn't hold water.
Yeah. No, it was the professed goal, I believe, the Soviet Union to basically take over the world. I mean, when China does not talk like that. I don't think there's much evidence they are like that. I think, if anything, there's more evidence that we want to convert the entire world to our ideology, which, of course, I prefer to theirs. But I don't see much evidence that they actually want to convert the world to their ideology. I see them as much more realpolitik in their relations with the world. And, you know, in general, the China hawks, you know, China hawkism has overtaken the establishment so rapidly that nobody ever visits first principles. Nobody ever bothers to explain, like, what exactly is the threat to America's national security, long-term, short-term, whatever. And, you know, is it the case? I just want to say one more thing about this. You know, Dmitry, is it Alperovitz or...
Alperovitz.
I had him on the podcast, big China hawk. Had a China hawk book, very good civil conversation. I like him a lot. And one thing I like about him is he conceded in the book that the maritime border disputes that China is involved in, which I think are indefensible as an adherent of international law, because in at least one of the cases, you know, the international adjudicatory body has spoken. But as Dmitry said, that's not a sign of endless expansionism. They have reasons to want to preserve beyond doubt their control of certain waterways that they consider critical because it's the way that oil enters their country. And so I don't know. You just, it's frustrating. The last thing I'll say, as long as we're talking about oil, is I don't think people understand what this chip war looks like from China's point of view. I've got to think it's comparable to the way Japan viewed the oil embargo before World War II, which presumably played a role in the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Not that Japan wasn't doing horrible things that the oil embargo is in response to, but I think it's considered that level provocation in China.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that is probably a good point for us to finish off this first half of the episode, unless you have anything else you would add. Yeah, so we'll move now to my interview with Elizabeth Beavers, who, again, is a expert in national security law. And we're going to be talking all about the Trump administration's use and the history of various different types of terror designations. It's a very interesting conversation. So
I will definitely be listening. Thanks for doing all the work on the newsletter this week.
Yeah, happy to do it.
And next week.
All right.
All right. See you, Connor.
See ya. Hey, Elizabeth, how you doing?
Hi, Connor. I am living the dream in Trump's America. How about you?
Exactly the same. Yeah, it's off to a fast start. It's off to a chaotic start. I can't even keep track. I know. And I'm glad you're joining today, because the speed of events has actually made it very difficult to keep track of some of the genuinely very interesting national security issues that are happening here. And
totally.
You're a great guest to talk about one aspect of this, which is the fact that the Trump administration in these first couple weeks is really starting to do a lot with different types of terror designations, right? So in the time since Trump's taken office, he's already redesignated Yemen's Houthis as a terror group. He's reinstated Cuba's designation as a state sponsor of terror. And he's even threatened to declare Mexican cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. And you're the perfect person to talk about this, because you study these very closely. You're an adjunct professor of counterterrorism law at the University of New Hampshire. And I know that you've been looking specifically into terror designations a lot over the past year or so for some research that you've been doing. So I guess before we get into all those details, could you sort of just lay out for us a little bit the history of these terror designations?
Yeah, totally. So it ended up being a little more prescient than I anticipated. About a year ago, I started really digging deep for a particular law journal article that I've got coming out this spring, digging into terror designations. And it's really interesting stuff. So there are a few different lists that exist in U.S. federal law that allows the executive branch to name people, organizations, or even entire governments as terrorists or supporters of terrorism. And most of the lists came about in the late 90s, but then really ramped up in usage post 9/11. The state sponsors of terrorism list is a different case. It came about in 1979. It was as part of everything that was going on and kind of Cold War tensions. And that one is a little bit of an outlier, but the rest of them have actually not existed that long. It's very interesting, because, you know, when each of these were put down, they gave a tremendous amount of discretion to the executive branch. And we can go into the various legal standards that do and don't exist on these different lists about what criteria they have to use for whether to list someone or not. At the time, there were like a few warnings, like, hey, this seems like a lot of discretionary power to give to the world's most powerful empire to just sort of blacklist various entities as terrorists and put just devastating consequences on them as a result. And we have seen that bear out across bipartisan administrations, what it looks like to use these lists. And Trump is kind of starting to get into really like pushing the envelope back on it. But really, like, the precedent is it's not what he's doing. It's not an aberration. Like, these the law exists. It has been sort of messed with for various U.S. political purposes for a long time.
Yeah, and why, you know, the groups that are designated as foreign terrorist organizations, specially designated terrorist groups, all these different things, they're obviously already doing a wide range of activity that is illegal under U.S. law, right? They're already doing lots of things that you could pursue through different types of, let's say, counter-narcotics things or just simply, you know, counter-murder, literally, for a lot of these groups, right? Is fairly, like, straightforward thing. Lots of what they're doing is already illegal.
Laws. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's a big one.
Yeah, no, you're like, that's exactly it. And that's the important distinction here is that, like, there's already such a labyrinth of federal law that criminalizes particular behaviors and actions where there are already, and not even just in criminal law, like there's so many sanctions authorities, like there are all kinds of penalties to pin on specific behaviors and actions. What the terrorists are, though, is something different. It is punishment for association and for identification with a particular group or with a particular government or for being a particular individual. Now we can like debate all day, like, is that a proper use of authority? Is that like a good thing for the government to have? I don't think so. I actually concluded in my research, I don't think these lists should exist. I think they're totally duplicative of other laws that actually punish behaviors. And in fact, they open us up into just punishment of association. But that is the critical thing. It is literal just blacklisting. And then the consequences that flow downstream are for those who are on list or associated with those who are on list many times, even if there's no actual like acts of violence that have been committed or even alleged to have been committed.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, why don't we let's come back to that broader argument later, but maybe why don't we just dive right into some of the specifics here? So I think maybe the most interesting one is this Trump effort. He released an executive order on his very first day in office, saying that within 2 weeks, he essentially wants the State Department to designate a group of cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. Can you lay out what the impact of that would be and sort of what the logic that Trump claims behind the decision would be?
Yeah, totally. So there, I'll note that his executive order contemplated a couple of different lists. One of them is the foreign terror organization. The other one is the SDGT list, the specially designated global terrorist. So we'll see at the conclusion of this, do they list some of these cartels as one or both, whatever. But I'll kind of hone in on the FTO designation. It is the most consequential. This is one that did come about in the late 90s. It was post Oklahoma City bombing, which is very interesting because there are definitely no like foreign organizations involved with that, but it's incredible the power that the executive seems to get after tragedies like this, even if they're unconnected to the tragedy that spawned the legal reforms. But that is what we got, is the FTO list. And so the requirements there is that the Secretary of State, to add an organization to the FTO list, they have to certify the organization is foreign, it engages in terrorist activity, or has the capability and intent to engage in terrorist activity, and that activity threatens U.S. national security or the security of U.S. nationals. Now, what's interesting here is how we are defining terrorism, right? Like, that's the whole thing. So in this context, terrorism is defined as premeditated, politically motivated violence perpetrated against noncombatant targets by subnational groups or clandestine agents. And then terrorist activity is much more widely defined. Any activity that is unlawful under U.S. law or the laws of the place where it was committed and involves hijacking, sabotage of aircraft, vessel, vehicle, other conveyance, hostage taking, violent attack on internationally protected person, assassination, use of biological agent, chemical agent, nuclear weapon, device, explosive firearm, or other weapon or dangerous device other than for mere personal monetary gain, intent to endanger, directly or indirectly, safety of one or more individuals to cause substantial damage to property, or any threat or conspiracy to do any of these activities. So thanks for bearing with me as I run through that definition. But as you
that's crazy.
See,
that's quite a list.
Like that's like what did I've probably done something at some point that like endangered property. I don't know. Actually, probably not. But like this is, it's a really wide definition, and they really just kind of have to certify that. And it's very difficult to impossible to ever challenge that in court. Like, they just sort of have to, like, that is the criteria. And so there's actually like a lot of really wide discretion there So if, you know, if an organization is added to the FTO list, what it means, what the consequences are, any who are associated with that FTO are barred from entering the United States and potentially subject to deportation if already here. There are sanctions that follow, meaning U.S. financial institutions freeze any existing assets belonging to the organization, and all those who are associated with the organization are usually barred from any further transactions with U.S. entities and financial institutions. But the biggest consequence that I really want to highlight, and this is unique to the FTO list specifically, it's not true for the SDGT list or others, is that it also is a federal crime to provide material support to an FTO, which I guess maybe sounds fair enough on first glance. But what material support means, it's defined really broadly in the statute. It's providing any property, tangible or intangible, any service, expert advice or assistance, training or personnel. It could mean yourself, could be personnel. So, I mean, that effectively criminalizes membership in a designated group, association with a group, any kind of like assistance, anything that flows to the group, and not even necessarily for violent ends. And in fact, there was kind of like an infamous Supreme Court case in 2010 that clarified, like, oh yeah, you can be held criminally liable even if you are trying to help that group pursue their ends peacefully, or you're providing nonviolent assistance to someone in the group. So like it's really, really broad, and so, you know, we can get into, like, you can imagine a bunch of downwind consequences where those 1, 2, 3 steps removed from cartels could have their lives completely upended if they actually follow through with this.
Yeah, that's something. There was an interesting news line about that in the New York Times that I saw people kind of dunking on a little bit on Twitter, but that I thought was very sort of perceptive, which is just that, you know, so many American businesses, so many people throughout the legal economy in Mexico are simply sort of unable to fully separate themselves from the cartels, which are these things that have deeply pervaded Mexican society, Mexico's economy. And the consequences for, I guess, rigorous enforcement of a terror designation could be sort of devastating,
totally.
Not just to the cartels, but to everyone that's tied into them.
Yeah, that's it. I think people think like, oh, okay, so you can't give money to a cartel, seems fair enough. No, like that's not quite what we're talking about here. When an entity is particularly embedded in an economy, U.S. financial institutions are very, very like risk averse when it comes to facilitating any sort of continued economic activity in areas where FTOs are fairly active. This is why it's so controversial. Yeah. When the Houthis were designated and then they were undesignated and now they're redesignated, whatever, is because like that has a big effect on the people who actually live in the ground in Yemen, because huge parts of Yemen are by de facto controlled by the Houthis. They are sort of like the de facto government. And so it's pretty impossible for a U.S. financial institution to really do separate out like what potentially could flow to the Houthis, what is just, you know, happening on the ground. And going to others. And so it really exacerbates the poverty at the ground level, because U.S. banks just kind of shut down in areas where there's a big FTO presence and they're really embedded in the local economy. So particularly when it comes to Mexico, like this has the potential to really exacerbate poverty conditions and really make things a lot worse, which of course like kind of strengthens cartel's power and the ability to sort of like feed off of those conditions. So this is not just about money going specifically to those designated, is all around them, associated with them, in the same local economy, potentially are going to get things shut off. And like this could affect things like family remittances and like various all the different ways that economies are intertwined.
Yeah. And what was the argument when this became law, or maybe this just was something that was not paid attention to super close, but what was the argument in favor of such broad authority with such, it seems like there's almost no check on this, that there's no real ability for someone to petition to have this changed, or even for Congress to exercise its like oversight functions.
Yeah, I mean, basically the designation stays in place until the executive decides otherwise. That's pretty much how it goes. An organization can challenge its designation in court, but it is almost impossible to to win. The courts are.
Has that ever happened? Has anyone ever tried?
I don't think so. I'm not aware of it. I don't think so. There's some like really interesting jurisprudence where even that third element of like, does this group pose a security threat to the United States or U.S. persons? Courts have even kind of decided that that's not even proper for the courts to review. That's just an executive determination. Mm-hmm. And we're like not even going to look at that part. So at that point, you're left with the other two criteria, like, are we a foreign organization and have we engaged in terrorist activity using that really broad definition? It's pretty, especially when you can't even see all the evidence against you because the executive is able to have classified evidence that they put as part of the docket for justifying why they're designating you. So it is like impossible to challenge your designation. I mean, at the time when this came up, it was post Oklahoma City bombing, but pre 9/11, which is really interesting. So I think it was at a time when actually thinking about we weren't at the time in the middle of a really protracted military paradigm, like global war paradigm against these groups. And it sounded like, oh, they're, you know, scary foreign groups. Yeah, seems to make sense that we would like not give them money, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I think in fairness, like there were warnings at the time. There were a few members of Congress when they were debating this law that the FTO designation authority is packed up in. We're saying like this seems like a lot of authority. Seems like it's actually put. We could see where this could go sideways, where this could be used functionally as like a political blacklist someday. So it's not like no one said that. It's just more votes felt the other way.
Yeah, that's super interesting. That's super interesting. And do we have a sense? So, you know, what would the difference be in practical terms between if these are foreign terrorist organizations or specially designated global terrorist groups? Is that the term?
Yeah. Yeah. The main difference is that the material support crime is only for FTOs. So you can only be held criminally liable in U.S. federal law for providing material support to an FTO. That same crime does not exist with regard to SDGTs. But the other thing with SDGTs is it can be individuals or organizations. So like there's more people who can be included, but the similar sanctions apply, similar immigration restrictions apply. So some of those same financial concerns would still follow. What would be different is the criminalization of material support. And, you know, a context where I've studied where material support crimes follow FTO designations in a way that is enormously problematic is really with regard to Israel-Palestine. And I super recommend, there's an incredible report that Center for Constitutional Rights and Palestine Legal, led by the incredible scholar Daryl Lee, put out a report about how U.S. counterterrorism law, like, is sort of the whole basis of why it exists, is for additional authority for suppressing Palestinian liberation efforts and nurturing the exceptional relationship that we have with Israel. It is very much baked into the fabric of, to mix a bunch of metaphors, what counterterrorism law is, including the designations. So, you know, where we have seen this come up in the last year or so, post October 7th attacks, and what's happening in Gaza is, you know, Hamas is a designated terror organization. Hezbollah and, of course, Iran is a state sponsor of terror. Like there are a bunch of designations that are wrapped up in what's happening in Gaza. And because of that, it is a crime, it is a federal crime to give any sort of material support to a terror organization. And so there is a plausible case where those who are protesting what's happening in Gaza, for those who are protesting against Israel's actions, U.S. actions that are ostensibly to targeted at Hamas, could be potentially like prosecuted for giving material support to Hamas in the form of like support. Now, independent advocacy, I do want to like make clear, the Supreme Court has said that independent advocacy is First Amendment protected speech and can't be criminalized. But where it trespasses into criminalized conduct is when that advocacy is coordinated with an FTO. So it actually already happened where there was some litigation and there was some pressure on state attorneys general to take legal action against protesters arguing that they were like taking cues from Hamas, they were coordinating with Hamas, and that so any of the student protests were fell against the criminal prohibition on material support to a foreign terror organization. Now that hasn't like yet materialized into actual prosecutions. There were some there was some rumbling, but it could, and it's, you know, still possible. But it's not without precedent. I mean, the largest Muslim charity in America got shut down post 9/11 because it was designated as an SDGT. Because it was alleged to have been improperly providing resources through its charitable donations in the occupied Palestinian territories that somehow got to some group that was associated with Hamas. Like, there was never any allegation that they were like directly giving money to Hamas, and they were still shut down under these sanctions that flow out from SDGTs and FTOs. So what I'm trying to point out there is like, also not just foreign. Within U.S. society, there are big risks for like protests, for the suppression of dissent, for First Amendment activity, for our own economic activities. It gets really complicated and like really scary really fast.
Yeah, well, that helps to explain, I think, in sort of visceral terms, why banks are so, you know, banks being the ultimate sort of conservative with a small c institution, right? They're definitely not going to want to be within 1,000 miles of any of these organizations exactly. that are facing these designations.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, well, so sometimes it's not even a matter of like, oh, yes, this transaction is totally fine. So like it should go through. Like banks are just not going to touch it. And so the wide net that gets thrown out there is going to capture a lot of transactions and economic activity that shouldn't otherwise get caught up.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you mentioned the Middle East. This is one issue that I haven't brought up yet, but one interesting thing that is going to sort of play out in the coming months is the fact that obviously in Syria we have a government that is now led by someone who is... Nusra Front considered an FTO? Or is it still on the FTO list? Yeah,
I think FTO, yes.
Yeah, so we've still got, so it creates this interesting thing, like what would it actually look like? So I guess just for background for listeners, basically you've got obviously this group, this Islamist group that took power in Syria, toppled the Assad regime at the end of last year. The leader of that group, Ahmed al-Sharaa, was long designated as a terrorist by the US. There was a bounty on his head that has since been removed, but the group that he led is still considered to be a terrorist organization. And the question is, now that he is considered the lawful president of Syria, what happens next? Are we able to retract that? What is even the process for removing a terrorist designation? I'd be curious to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, totally. To me, this whole series of events has helped lay bare what a sham the terror designation lists are, because...
This was a free preview of
Non-Zero World.
To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member at nonzero.substack.com.